Hello and welcome to Outward for September 2022. I'm Christina Cotarucci, a senior writer at Slate.
And I'm Jules Gill-Peterson, your co-hostess with the mostess.
And this month, while our very much in-demand Brian is outwriting his book, can you believe that? He's going to be an author. We have a very special guest host. Our guest of honor will be familiar to the old Outward heads, those of you who were listening to us from the very beginning. He was one of our founding co-hosts, the brilliant, the beautiful Brandon Tensley. Brandon, welcome home.
Hello. There's no place like home. There's no place like home, which will be very relevant to our conversation today.
Oh, yeah. Good call forward. So, Brandon, you know, we've almost just about forgiven you for leaving us. What have you been up to?
I just hit my three-year anniversary at CNN. I was on the politics team. Now I'm on the race and equality team. And so covering the intersection of culture, identity, and politics.
And I just want to plug your amazing newsletter, which I open every week. Even if I don't have time to read it, I click it open because I know that helps. But most of the time, I put it at the very top of my reading list because I love the way you bring in queerness and often pop culture into every conversation about the news and politics. And I always want to hear what you have to say.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. I fight for those the queer stories in there. Yeah.
Thanks for being with us. So listeners, you know, right, that this is a show for everyone. And that means it's a show for you, whether you're sportif or more of a sporty spice, because those are the two categories, right? This month we're talking about sports in a gay way, of course. So we do have a little bit of an angle. We're going to be digging into two really fabulous entries from the wide world of streaming right now. So first, Christina, Brandon, and I will chat about A League of Their Own, the Amazon Prime series that came out last month, starring just an incredible ensemble cast, a show that tells the story of queer women, transmasculine people, shooting their shot to play ostensibly women's baseball in the 1940s. And then we'll sit down with the director and producer of Stay On Board, the Leo Baker story, a really wonderful documentary streaming on Netflix that tells the story of professional skateboarding star Leo Baker and his struggle to figure out how to make room for himself as a queer and trans pro athlete. So clearly, grab a towel and a water bottle because, honey, we're going to break a sweat. But first, as is our gay custom, it is time for Pride and Provocation. So, Christina, what have you got for us?
Oh, man, I'm provoked this month. I tried to avoid this provocation bait, but, you know, I'm only human. So y'all might have noticed that Jonathan Van Ness and Anthony, whatever his last name is, from Queer Eye, this week both tweeted these seemingly lovey-dovey photos of themselves. And the gist of the captions was, you know, after all these years, we're finally together. We're so happy. We're feeling so supported and loved. More tomorrow, you know, rainbow emoji. So it was clear to a great many of us that this was some sort of a teaser, like publicity stunt for a product that they would be launching together, or maybe a podcast or something. So especially for those of us who were still scarred by the fact that Jonathan Van Ness came out as non-binary as a promotion for their nail polish line with Essie, I believe, like gender neutral nail polish, because as we all know, nail polish in its traditional form is so gender exclusive. You know, non-binary people can't use regular nail polish. Anyway, those of us who remember that fateful promotion were like, oh God, here comes another product. But of course, the Pollyannas out there in the real world were responding to these posts like, congratulations, cuties. Oh my God, it's so sweet. So happy for you. And then there was a strain of response that was more like, wait a minute, isn't Jonathan married already? So how can they be with Anthony? And in response to that line of skepticism, there were a whole bunch of credulous LGBTQs who were chiming in to say, you know, people can be non-monogamous. Or, like, direct quote from one tweet, relationships can look like a lot of different things. Polyamory or other forms of non-monogamy are awesome for a lot of people. And I just want to say, come on, folks with an X. We don't have to fall for every stupid commercial ploy that comes across our feeds just because it's family. And also, perhaps more importantly, not everything has to be an earnest teaching moment about, you know, the diversity of queer relationships. I found this so cringe, it made me embarrassed to be queer. And then sure enough, the next day, the product was announced. It's pet food mix-ins. Not pet food, mind you. Mix-ins. So, like, substances.
What's a mix-in?
That you mix in. You mix it into your pet's food to make it taste better? I don't know. As if regular pet food is too bland for the pampered pet.
Yeah, it's delicious.
Yeah. So, you know, why are we like this? I don't know.
Yeah, I feel like we should know better.
How about you, Brandon? How are you feeling this month?
I am feeling pride this month. It's funny. I was actually going to be provoked because I remember back when I would co-host, like, I was always feeling pride.
Aww.
It always made you and Brian come across as, like, you know, the downers.
Well, I clearly played into that stereotype.
I know. When I saw you're going to be provoked, I was like, wow, I can be my true self. So last week, I went to my first NLGJA, LGBTQ journalist conference in Chicago.
Oh, cool.
Yes. And I hadn't been before. I just had a great time. I got to meet, obviously, a lot of queer journalists, but also a lot of queer colleagues, ooh, like people I didn't know were queer at CNN. Wow. Especially at the different bureaus in Atlanta, in New York. So I just had a great time. And I remember I fell in love with this. She's an investigative reporter at the Dallas Morning News, and her name is Lauren McGoffey. She covers gender, sexuality, politics in Texas, and she just killed this panel that she was on that was talking about post-Roe and sort of how the legal reasoning in that decision, how that affects a variety of different rights. But, you know, sometimes you watch a panel and, like, everybody's great, everybody's nice, but, like, a star emerges, yes, somebody who just steals the show. Yeah, and it was exactly like that. And I remember afterward, I, like, went up to her, and I was like, you're amazing. So I came away really, really, really inspired. Like, I feel like a lot of people go to conferences and understandably just come away feeling exhausted. And I was tired by the time I caught my, like, you know, 7 a.m. flight. But I just felt rejuvenated at the same time. And the last night that I was there, I got to go out in Boys Town, also known as North Halsted. It was great. So now I'm you know, dying to hit the conference circuit again next year.
Aw, I'm so happy for you, Brandon. I was actually at the 2019 Negligee conference. This is what June taught me, how you pronounce that
Negligee
acronym. NLGJA, Negligee.
I love it.
Brian and I were on a panel about podcasts together. And yeah, there's just something about being surrounded by people, well, A, by queers, and B, by people who are, like, actually really excited about doing better at their jobs. I loved it. It was real, like, you know, kid who sits in the front of the classroom energy.
1,000%.
What's up with you?
I have a bit of a reach this month. And, you know, there were a lot of other contenders for my feelings, but I just have to do this because, you know, as people may or may not know, I am a literal product of the British Empire. You know, half my family is from India. I was born in Canada. And so, okay, let's just say it. Her Majesty died. Okay, I'm not a monarchist, never have been, not a fan of empire. And I just want to say I'm provoked in general by anyone who just suddenly decided this week that they actually really love the British Empire, that they really love the House of Windsor, that they really love the monarchy. And if you're being like, okay, well, that's fine, honey, but that isn't gay. Yes, it is, because my provocation is you're a fan of the wrong queen, okay? That was not your queen. And if you want to understand, I mean, she was my queen. I've been forced to swear oaths to her and all sorts of other unspeakable acts up north. And, you know, I just have to say, you get very little in return, and you have to live with the fact that, you know, she was the legal and literal symbolic head of the thing that went around the world and just did unspeakable damage through colonialism, you know, benefiting from the transatlantic slave trade. I mean, just like, you know, keeping all the diamonds? I mean, come on. What more villainry do we need? Queens are people who carry themselves in a legendary manner, who snatch trophies, who appear on stage, and who own the street, okay? So enough said. From now on, that one queen is gone, right? So now you have no excuse anymore. No one likes a king, okay? We like short kings. We don't like literal kings. And so I'm just going to leave it there. Let's do a total global reset and fixate on proper queendom from now on.
The new Starz series, Marianne George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son, George, on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. You've never seen a mother-son duo like this before. The show is full of wit, scandal, action, and did I mention Julianne Moore? Something this audacious and sexy is as genre-bending as it gets. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Marianne George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
Our first topic this month is A League of Their Own, an Amazon Prime series that came out last month. If you're listening to this podcast, I'm sure you have some kind of feeling about it, or you're at least aware that it exists. So I don't know about you all, but I have to say, and, you know, don't revoke my queer card here, I was tempted to skip this series. Then three things happened. One was that multiple friends of mine, who are usually, like, just total snarky bitches, were posting these just earnest clips of the show on Instagram, not with no comment or commentary, just literally, like, a clip of Roberta Calandres doing her, smoking a cigarette or something. The second thing that happened was someone tweeted, I thought this was going to be a show about baseball with a side of gay, but it's actually a gay show with a side of baseball. And I was like, that was exactly my assumption. My interest is piqued. The third thing that happened that really pushed me over the edge was my friend, who's a lesbian, was telling me that, first of all, she loves the show, but also that her mom, who's straight, watched the show and said, like, you know, I enjoyed it, but wasn't it a bit gratuitous? And I was like, all right, I have to watch it now. And I have to say, I agree with that straight mom. It is extremely gratuitous. The whole thing to me feels like lesbian fan service. But I digress. The show, for those of you who don't know, is an adaptation and expansion of the 1992 Penny Marshall film by the same name. That one starred Gina Davis, Rosie O'Donnell, who plays the Silver Butch of My Dreams in the new version. Also Lori Petty and Madonna. Basically 100% queer icons were in the first one. And it was about the real life women's baseball league that started during World War II when all the men were off fighting in the war. But we as a nation just could not go a few years without watching baseball and probably falling asleep during baseball. So that movie was so formative for a whole generation of baby gays, and it was so queer, despite having zero queer storylines in it, zero explicit queer storylines, that actually we have a dyke bar in DC named A League of Their Own. It's just accepted as a canonically gay film, so much so that I feel like I've sort of memory holed the original version of the film the only version of the film that had no gayness in it. And I'm like, wait a minute, weren't there gay characters in that film? My partner was like, no one was gay. You just remember them as gay because we all sort of agreed that it was a queer film. Anyway, this new show was co-created by someone named Will Graham. Okay, good job, Will. But more importantly, Abby Jacobson, who stars in the show as Carter Shaw, a putatively straight married gal from Idaho who's never even had pizza before. Her husband is off at war, and she experiences an instantaneous queer awakening when she joins the Rockford Peaches baseball team. I'm sure many softball players out there can relate. There's also Shantae Adams, who I've never seen in anything before, but I am obsessed with. She plays Maxine, or Max, who's a black baseball nut who is just convinced that she could be a star pitcher if some league would just let her play. Darcy Carden, who played Janet on The Good Place, for those of you who watched that show, she is Greta, who's like a more experienced queer who has a fling with Carter. And my queen, Roberta Calindres, I would watch her do just about anything. She plays Lupe, the Peaches pitcher, who spends most of the season injured on the bench. This show, there's so much to talk about, but to kick us off, I want to talk about one of the most striking, and I have to believe controversial, choices that the creators and writers made on the show, which is that it's pretty loyal from an aesthetic sense to the 1940s, the period costumes, the production design, even the plot lines, but the dialogue and the mannerisms are straight out of 2022. Abby Jacobson feels like she's acting in Broad City. They say things like,
"What are you so happy about?"
I've never been in a convent before, and I love God.
Me too. Big fan. Yeah, let me show you around. Okay.
You know, when they're like entering a nunnery, I'm pretty sure one of the characters uses the word problematic. So, Jules, as our resident historian, how did that work for you? What function did that play for you? And did you like it?
Look, you know, let's say I don't have a lot of, like, studio execs in my life. I don't know anyone high up at Amazon yet. So, you know, I'm assuming, you know, it's like someone had a really, really big light bulb moment where they were like, well, if they talk like how we talk today, that's hashtag relatable. You know, okay, here we are. You gotta sort of play the hand you're dealt. But my reaction to that is like, you know, maybe listeners have sort of picked up on the fact that, like, I practically am a woman from the 1940s, okay? Like, I always, like, you know, I have wanted my whole life to talk with a mid-Atlantic accent. I'm not going to do it right now because I'm feeling a little shy. But I just, aww, you know, to me, there's a missed opportunity, you know, for the camp and kind of high femme sort of role. And also, actually, it could have been sort of a fault line to play with, both for like butch or trans mass characters who obviously can't fit into that sort of hiding in plain sight kind of 40s camp. But also, you know, for the black characters in the show to think about their relationship to that kind of racialized tone or presentation, as well as, you know, the Latinx characters too. So that to me feels like a bit of a missed opportunity.
Yeah, it wasn't clear to me whether the, you know, hashtag relatable dialogue was supposed to add some sort of new layer of meaning to the story, like trying to help us put ourselves in the shoes of these women in the same way that, like, you know, colorized old photos are supposed to make us realize, oh, these were real people and not just, you know, stuck in time, like images to project ideas onto. But actually, I think it was just to make it more memeable. And also, maybe Abby Jacobson only has one mode of verbal humor. And it's sort of that, like, awkward, self-deprecating, like, fish out of water style. Let me ask you about the straight mom's review of the show. Did you feel it was gratuitous? How did you feel about the fact, and I don't know if you guys knew this going in, that all of the main characters were queer and that, like, at least one of them, the main character, went from, like, not knowing what lesbianism was to making out with a woman on day one of the baseball league?
So was this mom, was she using gratuitous in a, like, in a sort of negative way, like,
yeah, love it. Like, so she was, and I think of it in that way. Okay, okay. Positive, where let me be a little clearer with what I'm getting at here. So it felt to me a little bit like they're just giving us what we want. And base level, I was so happy. I was like, oh, wow, this really is a show. None of it is really surprising necessarily. It sort of hits all of the notes that you would expect a queer historical drama to hit. And I'm wondering whether that pleased you guys or whether you felt a little bit like, oh, okay, this is like you just took a fan fiction and made a show out of it.
One thing that works really well with the series is that it feels very sort of storyline first, very character first. Yes. You know, there are a lot of queer characters in there, but it never came across as like didactic or like we're trying to sort of smuggle in these things, which I feel like can make for like bad art. It felt very much like, you know, we're going to give dimension to all of these different characters, and it makes them feel very true to life, and also they're queer. And so it felt like the direction was like, we want an engaging, sort of compelling story, and also these characters are queer. And so to me, it felt less gratuitous, I guess. But then also I was surprised. I thought like maybe like one character would be queer. So when I, you know, as I watched it and I learned like how many queer characters are, I was like, oh, wow, like it's almost the whole team.
Yeah.
Which may be real. That might be true to life for all we know about the baseball leagues back then, because it does feel like the alternative approach, which was the original film, to make no characters explicitly queer is just as ahistorical as someone saying the word problematic in 1940.
Mm. Yeah, no, I'm so glad you both were interested in that aspect, because I have to admit, like, it kind of got me. You know, I started watching and I was like, okay, wait a minute, what? Like, all of these people are gay, like, and some of them are clearly trans, but oh, I see, like, the show only has room for maybe like one or two queer romance storylines or something, so we can't. And then, you know, later on, without giving away too much, like, it kind of, the show kind of pulls back the curtain and is like, oh, no, actually they all were, but like our point of view characters didn't quite get that. And I was like, oh, damn, y'all got me. And I actually think that was a really smart choice, because like, to me, then gratuitous takes on a different significance. Like, I feel like, and maybe like straight viewers wouldn't, well, I don't even know, because I'm like, again, a historian of sexuality, and I know a lot about the 1940s. And so I watch it in like a really ridiculously intense way. But I actually, the thing that I liked sort of about, it's not about historical accuracy alone, I actually think it's a good storytelling device, was that the show made a kind of decision to sort of, you know, visually, storyline-wise, a little dissociate our access to queerness. And it also made, I think, maybe like the only kind of smart choice the show makes about race is to, it actually like digs into segregation. And, you know, the Black characters, their storylines on the show are physically, story-wise, separated from the non-Black team. And we're, you know, especially following Max, you know, on the one hand, Max's story is about how much she just cannot get onto a field. Like, she cannot throw a ball for any team. And it's like, you know, in the first episode, I was like, oh, okay, are they just going to do this for episode one? And at the end of episode one, she's going to somehow make it onto the team, which just seems really like a little, you know, like, okay, let's not pretend that's America. And then they don't. And I was like, oh, cool. Because then you also get to see, you know, a Black social world, in particular, a Black queer and trans social world that is sort of figuring out how to bloom within, you know, Northern segregation. So I think like that kind of storytelling, I don't know how intentional it was, but like, I think it's really good as a storytelling device. But it also just, to me, it allowed for a little more depth. So yeah, like there are different kinds of queerness, right? It's not just like there are 2022 lesbians, you know? So like, despite the sort of like the way people are talking, I actually feel like there's a range of queer people. There's a range of different kinds of people, many of whom like were 1940s kinds of people. So there was something about that I found actually quite satisfying. And I really appreciate it because I can't think of a show that has been that thoughtful about that before. I feel like there's just so much pressure to take like contemporary identity and say like, there must have been people like that in the 1940s too, but they were erased or hidden or repressed. And it's like, no, actually they had their own lives. Like they navigated the world as it was, right? And so like a lot of queer life was sort of hidden, but like not really hidden, because it's like pretty obvious when you put these people in skirts and throw them on a field that they just look insanely gay. And you know, I feel like there's something sort of helpful. There's something a bit refreshing about that. Although it did make me wonder, just to say one more thing about the dialogue issue, where I was like, as again, as a weirdo nerd historian, you know, it's like, I'm sure it's really hard for people to imagine, like, how did gay people talk to each other in 1943, right? And actually, to answer that question is, like, quite challenging. Like, if I had been consulting on that, on the dialogue on the show, like, I would have really had to think about it, because it would have been so class stratified. It would have been so stratified by region in the United States, and it would have been so, you know, so much collected around racial segregation, that actually figuring out how to make people talk to each other, also like talk to each other when they're in front of cameras playing a baseball game, or when they're at the secret gay bar in town, right? When they're alone having an intimate moment, right? Or having sex, versus when they're talking to their coach, right? It's, those are not super, super clear things to figure out either. So I have a little bit of, I guess, like begrudging respect for that challenge. But I just think at the storytelling level, the show is pretty good about it.
That is such a good point about the difficulty of constructing that kind of dialogue, in part because, like, we probably know how people wrote letters to each other, but there's no, like, we don't have voice memos. We don't have, you know, like, clips of people out in the wild in their most private moments speaking to one another. And I'm sure, you know, there wasn't like a queer monoculture, as you said. It's like people in different parts of the country who were queer may not have ever met each other and shared their terminology for things, or people in Max's world would not have necessarily interacted, certainly didn't, you know, as we see in the show, interacted with people in Carson's world. Yeah. And for the first two episodes, I felt like, they're trying to do too much by having Max's whole storyline take up half of the episode, and then the white and Latina baseball team taking the rest of the episode. Like, how are we going to care about both of these two worlds? It took a couple episodes, but I actually think I did end up caring about both worlds and feeling like I understood and cared about the characters in both places. And just to bring it back to sports for a second, the fact that Max was not able to play on either the integrated men's team or the white and Latinx women's team made her worse at baseball, because she didn't have a chance to play with anyone. And I felt like that was a really deftly written metaphor for the way that exclusion, like, dims people's prospects and, like, dims their talent and their possibility. And I feel like there were a couple moments in Max's world that gave me the most, I mean, I felt like titillated by much of what was happening in the other world, in both worlds, but the most, like, deeply emotional moments were for me when Max, before she had come out to anyone in her life, was sort of witnessing people talk about people who she loved and perhaps thought, like, maybe if I come out to them it would be okay, then hearing them talk about a queer person that they knew, a trans person, saying, like, just terrible things about him, and having her sort of realize on camera, like, oh, these people who I love so much and who accept me in so many other ways will actually detest me, ostracize me, and I'll lose my relationship with them if I show them my full self. That was, like, I don't know, probably more so than the dialogue, something that I felt like I could also relate to from, you know, earlier in my sort of journey. And, like, they didn't even need to make it hashtag relatable for me to relate to it, because those stories still play out in different ways today.
Yeah, I'm really glad you both brought up the structure, because I felt the same way at first. Where at first I was like, is this going to work? Is this not going to work? But definitely, yeah, by like episode 2 or 3, I was very down for it because I thought one thing that it showed, in addition to everything else you both have said, is I thought that it really captured the sort of belatedness that Max had to face. Like, you have these two parallel sort of storylines, and as the Peaches, they're starting to thrive, they're coming into their own, you know, by episode like 5 or 6, and then you still have Max in her storyline, who's still struggling just to be taken seriously, who is like, oh, if I get a job at the factory, then I'm able to like be on this team or to try out for the team. And so I thought it showed just like how one group is sort of, you know, they have their own challenges, but they're able to start sort of thriving under those challenges. And then you have Max, who is still just trying to, you know, she just wants someone to like look at her and see her skills. And so I thought that the structure also did a really great job of capturing that.
I want to give you guys the chance to bring up any characters or scenes or issues that you want to talk about too.
Well, I would love to talk about, Max's Uncle Bertie a little bit. One of my favorite characters I've seen in a television show in a really long time. And, you know, I'm not really like a big representation matters kind of girl, but I think there was something just so powerful to me about seeing a working class Black trans man from the 1940s. And again, you know, happy to be our resident historian and say, like, they did a pretty good job, you know, like, you know, it's complicated, right? I mean, the notion that being queer or trans automatically, you know, means sort of the loss of your kinship structure or the loss of your family is, you know, in America, a pretty whitewashed assumption. And I don't think that it's actually always accurate, especially not historically in different Black communities. And, you know, especially in the 1940s. Yeah, I just, you know, the way that the show sort of brings us to Max learning, you know, that someone who she thought of very differently is a man, is her uncle, right? And actually is living quite unapologetically, very skillfully, very strategically, you know, in a very smart way, you know, has a partner. And you know, Max sort of starts off the series, you know, with her mother being her sort of the primary person in her life, and her mother sort of being really, you know, kind of like the mayor of the Black community in Rockford where they live, and comes to find out that her Uncle Bertie is also kind of like the mayor, you know? And like, it turns out, right, that Black life in this town is actually much more complicated than she knew. And there's just something about the performance, you know, that the actor brings to the performance, this kind of, it really, I mean, for me, it really hits both, like, in terms of historical accuracy and just, like, hits, like, emotionally, you know, there's a kind of, a really well put together kind of confidence, a certain kind of wisdom earned, you know, by a way of life. And just this kind of like, you know, there's a little bit of a kind of mentoring relationship going on there. And the way that Bertie sort of plays that masculine, you know, that sort of butch trans masculine kind of mentoring role. You know, there's a scene, you know, at a party, you know, a Black queer party, where, you know, Max and Bertie are chatting in one room and have kind of had a moment where they needed to make up over something diegetically. And, you know, Max has kind of had her eye on a woman at the party. And Bertie, you know, is sitting there in just an absolutely fucking impeccable tailored suit and kind of glances over his shoulder and looks at Max and says, like, is that your girl?
Is that your girl?
No, I don't know her. I never met her.
Well, you better get going. Go ahead, get going.
Okay.
In that one moment, I was like, yes, that's exactly, like, it's not just like, that's exactly what that person would have said, but like, it just showed so much about a kind of, you know, about the true, like, you know, just the fact of that kind of, you know, Black masculine mentoring in that era, that it like takes these like really, you know, I don't know, just like so much was said in that moment without having to be didactic and telling. And I just so you know, I guess I'm a sort of like defensive, protective viewer. I'm like, please don't didacticize Black queer and trans stories. Yeah. Please don't turn them into teachable moments for a white audience, for any audiences, but especially for white audiences. And I just feel like there's this respect commanded by the character Birdie that is gentle and thoughtful, but like unmistakable. And it just, you know, I don't know. I just have a little bit of goosebumps about it because I guess Birdie is the kind of person that like I've encountered in my research. I've spent a lot of time thinking about in my head, you know, I've always imagined like, what would he look like? What would he sound like? How would he walk into a room? Who would be his people? You know, and even if I could know that intellectually, to see that brought to life in a performance is just really moving. So I just, you know, and I don't know that the show is marketed at all sort of to lead with that. You know, it's like, I know people who know that actor. And, you know, I feel like there's like a lot of like in the community, like people really excited about this kind of moment as in terms of like acting possibilities and jobs and stuff. But I just really want to underline it because I think like, even if the rest of the show was a dud, I would be like absolutely proselytizing people to watch it just to meet Uncle Birdie.
When you talk about how glad you were that it wasn't didactic, I feel like the show was written to allow people to come into it with the kind of naivete that Carson was when, you know, she has no idea like what queerness is. She doesn't know any queer people. She doesn't know even if she is queer. And then you have Max, who has been doing queer stuff since she was a teenager, but is still sort of new to this queer community. And so you, in both storylines, you have people who can sort of serve that role for the viewer as like, oh, I'm still kind of learning about this. I'm excited when we go to the secret gay bar for the first time or the incredible like Black queer party for the first time. But, you know, nothing would be necessarily explicitly spelled out for those characters. It's a lot of understanding by osmosis. And I feel like the writers gave the viewers that kind of respect, too, where we're allowed to just sort of witness and observe and absorb instead of saying, like, you know, well, as you know, we are not allowed in white spaces. So here we are with our own, you know, actually amazing space that makes us not even, we're not like sad we can't get into the white gay bar. You know, we have like two equally incredible parties going on at the same time. And like everyone knows why that's happening.
Hear, hear. Also, just one thing that I didn't realize until maybe episode 3, but I sort of like, you know, squealed with joy when I saw that Jamie Babbitt directed, I think, the first 3 episodes. Yeah. And I was like, I imagine that also brought sort of like another degree of sort of thoughtfulness to queer storylines to have, you know, the person who directed But I'm a Cheerleader also involved with the show.
I also think it's notable that Abby Jacobson had a somewhat late in life coming out story. And she has said that, you know, this helped me bring that sort of excitement and also fear to that character, that feeling of like, oh, whoa, I've been eating like warm bread my whole life and now I get to have pizza. But also I could get arrested for having pizza. Obviously, that's not true in Abby Jacobson's life, but I love thinking about the way that, you know, these creative products that are exciting to watch may also be personally fulfilling sort of narrative stories to play out for the people in them. And one of the players, one of the Rockford Peaches who inspired the original story, just came out as gay at age 95 as sort of part of the promotional rollout for this film. So there's kind of a lot of little heartwarming side stories to this whole show. All right, listeners, we would love to hear what you think about this show. Again, it's A League of Their Own, and it's on Amazon Prime. You can email us with your thoughts at any time at outwardpodcast@slate.com.
So I like to think that we're entering something of a golden age for trans documentary, because we've been seeing a lot of really innovative storytelling and also just subject matter in recent documentary films, both about and also, I think, really importantly, produced by trans people that are just so much more interesting than the kind of older, you know, standard fare that tended to be a little bit more objectifying or certainly often centered around tragedy narratives. And so here comes Stay On Board, a really moving and thoughtful film that's now streaming on Netflix. And this documentary follows Leo Baker,
a world-renowned pro skater in the run-up to the very first Olympic Games in which skateboarding was going to be included as a sport, which would have been in 2020. But having been forced his whole career to hide from the public that he's trans, both sort of to satisfy the gender segregation of elite sport and also maybe corporate sponsorships, the film really digs into a kind of pivotal period during which Baker has to decide whether to continue putting off so much of what he wants for his life, including top surgery, in order to be able to compete at the Olympics. And I've never really seen a film quite like this. And I also want to say Leo is just the most charming protagonist. Personally, he really reminded me of all the skater boys I used to crush on in high school because I grew up in the Pacific Northwest. But obviously, that's a story for another day. Mm-hmm. We're so happy to welcome two really key people from the film. Alex Schmitter is a producer who's worked on a number of really exciting recent projects that I would also encourage listeners to check out, including Changing the Game, which you can find on Hulu, Disclosure, which is on Netflix, and a little old movie called Framing Agnes, where I first got to meet Alex. You know, we're talking about somebody here who is, you know, Emmy, Peabody, and Critics' Choice Award nominated talent. And speaking of winners, we're also joined by Nicola Marsh, who's worked on some really incredible projects, including the Oscar-winning film 20 Feet from Stardom, and just has like a suite of Showtime and Netflix credits that can make anyone blush in Los Angeles. So Nicola is the incredibly talented director of Stay On Board. So Alex, Nicola, welcome to Outward. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
So thrilled to be here.
To get us started, I wonder if both of you could maybe say a bit about kind of how just this project got started, especially you, Nicola. I mean, you know, the film sort of opens in 2019. And as someone who was watching as a total newcomer to pro skating, I kind of am just sort of curious, like, were you always like a Leo Baker fan, or like what got you into this project in the first place? And maybe more broadly, like what interested both of you about telling a story about queer and trans pro athletes?
The project first came to me because one of the executive producers was a good friend of mine, and I work quite heavily and for a long period of time in documentaries. And this guy, Retta, who was this skater dude, wanted to make a documentary about Leo, and he had never done a feature doc before. And the executive producer, my friend Ember, introduced me, and I was like, this is great. This is all the elements that you want in a doc, which is like the sort of candy wrapper around a really serious topic. Mm. And it's issues that we often want to talk about, but are really difficult to access because they're either totally cerebral or they're off-putting for a mainstream audience or whatever it is. You don't want it to be just a sort of like talking head documentary. The purpose of documentaries, not all of them, but a lot of them, are to try and embody with the body an idea. And here was Leo being like, how do you embody personal choice? Leo's going to show us. And how does he have agency in this world that is at every turn trying to hem him in? And so then we started making it. And then we desperately needed Alex. You know, we started cutting, making cuts, and the cisness of our lens became really obvious. And it wasn't appropriate for sort of Leo to be the educator on that. And it became clear to me that I didn't know enough about what I was doing. And I, at the time, I was like, I'm a lesbian. I get it. Like, coming out. Sure. Yeah. Who doesn't get this? But I think there's a real tendency amongst the gay community to sort of subsume the trans community within it. And I think I was really guilty of doing that myself. And it was becoming really problematic in the edit, like really problematic.
Mm. Alex, did you feel that way when you came on board?
Came on board to stay on board. You know, I had actually known Nicola and Retta for a few years because I was in the process of producing Changing the Game and going through my own journey of understanding my own discomfort with trans inclusion in sports, even as a trans person myself, just because we're inundated by media that is telling a specific narrative. And so I'd been going on my own personal and professional journey with learning and unlearning about this topic. And so when I met Nicola and Retta, we had a very honest conversation. It was before COVID that we met, and they were talking about Leah was going to have top surgery, and they were going to be following his journey in that, and all these things were evolving. And
also in 2019, like Leah wasn't even going by Leo. Like, we had no idea that he was really just gonna go with it at that point. Mm. We were like early on, and COVID hadn't happened, and the Olympics at the time felt right around the corner, and then they obviously got delayed, and you know, it just was like, it just, we didn't quite understand how much pressure there was going to be on him, because the whole thing was going to be done in 9 months, you know, and how public all of that was going to be. And I was just really drawn to it because I'm really drawn, I mean, gender has always been something I've been really intrigued by, and construction in general. And here was Leo in his totally unacademic setting, you know, like I've explored it a lot academically, but like, this was like, not that he wasn't even thinking about it in terms of like, you know, maybe Mel, his girlfriend, was thinking about the binary, but he was just like out living his life, being his real self, you know?
When I saw the first cut, there was a lot to work with. From Leo's perspective as well, it's hard when you are in the process of these major life events. So what Leo was communicating, but what is important to him, then it's up to documentary filmmakers and storytellers to take what he's saying and put that into a narrative that's going to go out into the world, and what gets to remain private and what is public. And so when I first came onto the team, we just had a lot of difficult conversations about what that would look like. And while something is really important to Leo, does he get to keep that for himself, or is that for public consumption as well? And so, you know, this kind of collaboration, I always say, can only happen with willing participants, with willing conspirators and collaborators. And Nicola, Retta, and myself, and our editor, who we brought on, Sasha Perry, who was brilliant, all engaged in an honest and good faith dialogue about the nuances and complexities of telling Leo's very particular and specific story, while knowing that on a global platform such as Netflix, people inevitably are going to take Leo and use him as an example of all trans people of all time. And so that was also really important for us in the edit and interviews, for him to be able to say, this is me, this is my story, and I'm speaking for myself and no one else. And it's something I really love about how the documentary ends up, is that there are many iterations, and every version of us counts.
It's really interesting to kind of look behind the curtain in this moment where we're seeing a lot more trans content, you know, trans representation. It's often presented to us just as a matter of inclusion, like input new content that was missing and things get better. But actually the process is a lot more complex. So there's something really very trans also, right, about making a film about someone who's going through that pivotal moment or a pivotal moment in their life and thinking about how you make that. But it is also, you know, a film about sports. And I think, you know, one of the interesting things that I know, you know, Christina and Brandon and I have kind of been thinking about is like, you know, I think sometimes for, let's call them outsiders to sports, like talking about myself, or casual fans, there's sort of this perception that organized sports, or maybe especially pro sports, are just kind of like inherently gay under the sort of broad rubric of quote unquote women's sports, right? So that like, oh, well, they must kind of be welcoming if like most of the people are secretly queer or not secretly queer. But I actually think one of the things that really stood out to me in this film and that I really appreciate is it actually digs very deeply into the gender policing and homophobia and transphobia that actually like comes almost with that perception that like, oh, there be queers here. Well, actually, yeah, that perception seems almost to like defensively, you know, cause all these problems. And so like this whole idea of like women skateboarding, you know, as a category, you know, even though like I kept feeling like when I was watching, I was like, well, this all looks so gay, but the people who are doing it seem very uncomfortable and very stressed out. And I guess, you know, you know, wondering sort of if my reading of that is kind of on track, and also sort of what are you kind of hoping that viewers of the film kind of walk away with sort of understanding better about how elite sport, even though like there are these jokes about like women's sports being very gay or whatever, that actually that sort of elite sport structure is even maybe more gender policed or even sort of more homophobic in some way.
Yeah, like just for an example, Leo was talking about how when he was younger, you know, he had long blonde hair and people really sort of latched onto that as like, this is great for marketing you, like mm-hmm. a girl skateboarder with long blonde hair. And like, there's this clash of like masculinity and femininity. And they really tried to put him into this box, even though, you know, when I think of skateboarding and especially like women's skateboarding, which was the category Leo was competing under, I think of like a whole big bunch of homos.
I think that when you get into the world of sports and or capitalism, you're entering into sort of like things that are predicated on sort of like win-lose game theory. You know what I mean? Mm. Like that's how it works. And that inevitably creates sort of binaries that the winner and a loser and a man and a woman. And like, even if it's gay, you're playing in the women's team and, you know, which I think is more the world that I came from. And it was really interesting to be subsumed into skateboarding and trans culture that were not those things at all. And it took a long time for me to be like, talking to Red and my co-director, being like, I just don't understand. Like, what's the point? Like, if you're not in a competition, you're just skating. But like, why? Like, how? Like, what's the point? And he's like, because you're skating for excellence, for personal, you know, and like, that was like, that's a crazy thing to do. And the trans idea was also that like, it doesn't need a category and definition. But then when you try to make money out of it, like either through marketing or competition, you sign into this compact to say, yeah, okay, I agree with this. Like it's tacit, but it's there. And then there's no space for you because your Leo was trying to sort of be two things at the same time. And the world was like, weird, no, don't want it.
I do want to come back to and ask a question about Leo, because, you know, again, for anyone who's listening who hasn't watched the film yet, it's like, you're going to fall in love with him. Such a sweetheart. So well-spoken too. And so there's this one moment that really kind of snatched my heart in the film, where I think Leo got a little philosophical. And so he says,
if I was living a different life, I might just transition and move to a new city and live happily ever after. But I'm in a space where I have to have a conversation about it with the world. And I don't want to.
You know, I took a beat when I heard him say that, because like, it's really profound. But then, as I often do when I'm watching something, I like shouted out loud at the TV, because I thought it was just so elegant. And it really summed up something that I wish was better understood about being trans, because so often, you know, identity and visibility and coming out are presented like, well, you just have to do this thing. And then it like makes your life better. And it's like, it's so good to express your true inner self. And not to say that people don't have, you know, their own true inner selves, but I think actually in reality, a lot of how our lives are structured and a lot of how trans people are antagonized aren't really about like our identities. It's a lot just about like work, you know, what you do for a living, who's paying your bills, like how you are able to function in the public world. And to be a pro athlete, you're under, you know, just a massive amount of scrutiny. And all of that is bound up in what kind of life you're allowed to live. And so I think what was so fascinating to me, like also as a historian, is Leo conjures like what was for a really long time, pretty standard trans procedure. Like you literally did used to kind of transition and move to a new city and start over and like be a new person. And, you know, as someone who also transitioned like a little bit publicly, like I totally get that envy. It just sounds like so much nicer to be able to do that. But I was sort of curious if like sort of this process, especially from a filmmaking perspective, Nicola, like following along with Leo for years, if that sort of is partially how the film became so much about like the job of being like a pro athlete. Like, you know, there's so many scenes where Leo's like, got to go to the airport, you know, trying to make a medical appointment, you know, in between all these trips, talking about like, when do you even get paid for things? Like, what money do you have to front just to get small? Like all this stuff. It's like, you know, gosh, like being a trans person is really expensive. And it's like not a foregone conclusion that being well recognized on the international scale pays for anything. And I'm just sort of curious if like, if that those are issues that were sort of front and center in the project, or was there something about kind of this process of following Leo over these years and like watching him day in and day out, like have to like do this job and eventually make some hard decisions about it? I'm just so curious, like how that emphasis in the film kind of came about.
Well, I mean, Leo said this thing to me, like after we'd finished the film, and like Netflix was asking us like, what pronouns should we use? And like, we write the little blurbs and it was like, do we say trans man? And I was like calling him up and being like, okay, like lay it out, because otherwise it's going to go out to like 150 countries, right? Not how you want it. And he said, I would just prefer not to be seen at all.
Wow.
Not that he wants to disappear, but he doesn't want to see himself reflected back in every conversation that he has. And I think as a trans man constantly calibrating his identity in each different setting, he was just so exhausted with that process of like presentation, and he would just like to not think about that for a second, right? And I think that passing allows you to not think about it for a second. The moving to another town and nobody knows your past, right? So you don't have to constantly be like me in the world and how I'm, and vis-a-vis my, how people work, just, and I think, it's really tiring. It's really tiring for him. And I think he's re-energized now because we stopped filming for a bit and the film has come out. But there was a period there where he was just like, I just want to be in my apartment and just be in my body and my skin and be present. But it's really difficult to be present when you're thinking about how other people are perceiving you. And his goal was to not be perceived. I think that is a luxury that you have when you have a more mainstream, powerful identity, right? As you spend less time thinking about what spaces you're safe in and what spaces you're not safe in, and you just get to walk through the world not thinking about yourself all the time.
Why do you think he agreed to participate in the documentary, given that he, you know, felt so exhausted by being perceived? I mean, there's almost nothing more aggressively perceiving than a documentary filmed over the course of years.
I mean, I think it's the duality of wanting somebody to bear witness to what the fuck you're going through, right? But then also just being really naive and not understanding what we were like, you know, we're gonna make a doc. And he was like, cool, never really watched that many of them, I'll do it. And I think there were several times where we were like, you know, we were like a dog with a bone, and he was like trying to shake out of our grip. And he was like, you know, not picking up our phone calls for a second. He's like, I'm really in it right now. I really don't want to talk to you guys. And then I think, you know, the lockdowns happened at a really great time for him and allowed us to build relationship without constantly being like, oh, can you say that on camera? Oh, can we film you again? Like, you know, just it was like a fallowness that was really helpful to his growth. He was also really nervous, obviously, in 2019, which is why, you know, he hadn't come out publicly about the reaction. And so when the doc came out and he, you know, came out to the world, and there wasn't this like incredible backlash, which I think, you know, even if it wasn't conscious, I think subconsciously he was nervous about it. I think that felt really a relief and validating. Like, I can just, I've done it, you know, I don't have to think about it anymore.
I feel like one thing that really struck me about the documentary was, last year I read Sean Fay's book, The Transgender Issue. And there's one part in there where she really talks about sort of the violence of the medical system toward trans people. I feel like sometimes it can be this sort of assumption that like doctors or whomever, like they always have your back sort of thing. But the part, and Jules talked about this a little earlier, but the part where Leo is trying to make an appointment and he needs his doctor to sort of like give permission and stuff like that, and just all these different roadblocks. But it just really sort of, I thought, painted a very vivid picture of just that the hostility, the violence that trans people run up against with the medical system. So I'm curious, like, how did you decide how much of these sorts of very sensitive, intimate moments to portray? I know you said that there were a lot of conversations and, you know, sort of, even if Leo says that he wants something, sort of like at some point, do you have to say like, maybe this isn't the best thing to include, like for like his own sort of like safety? Do we have to think about how he might feel about something later? But like, what was that like?
Yeah, there were lots of conversations about that. To be honest, it took me a second to understand a lot of the notes and to understand, like, one of our notes was like, time is a very cis concept. And I get it
what
now.
Does like, that mean?
It means that, like, when you make an observational doc about somebody who's going through transition, you're like, look at the before and look at the after and what time, right? And we really were leaning into that. And like, that's not interesting or new. The before and after in itself in life in general is not as clear as we want to believe it. It's just a sort of helpful categorization to help us remember when things happen, sort of. And so put these fake lines in our memory for when things start and stop. There were lots of things that I thought were really interesting and really tentative and reaching around for the light switch that maybe were a little bit too vulnerable. That part, right, of me understanding that, like, there is a whole wide world that this doc is going out to, and it's not just about the truth of Leo's lived experience, although that is part of it. And think about that.
So you're saying that there was also thinking of some kind of agenda.
You get really biological about how somebody is transitioning. That's going to read as a certain way to maybe cis audience that isn't particularly helpful and feels very observational and very sort of like this sort of hard lens of sort of perceiving and standing outside of the person. And so the goal of the documentary for me and Retta and Alex and Sasha was to try and make it as subjective as possible, to make it about Leo's experience, since you get a lot of sound design that has a lot of like trying to really bolt into what Leo's feeling in those moments, as opposed to like what it looks like that he's going through from the outside, right?
Getting the interior rather than the exterior and physicality, which is often the thing that's most focused on. But like, actually, I think one of the most beautiful transformations that happens in the doc is you see Leo in those moments where he's saying like, yeah, I considered killing myself. And then you see him in his final interview and there's a light in his eyes. Like, he is settled and embodied. And like, it's maybe more subtle than a physical transformation, but like, to see someone alive when they haven't been able to feel that way, like, that I think is what was so brilliantly captured by Nicola and Retta and Sasha in the editing, was like, that's actually a compelling transformation of saying, fuck the Olympics. Look how alive I am because I chose myself.
Another example is like that scene, the Lady Gaga scene in the car, right? When they're singing Lady Gaga, which I fought for. I mean, we all fought for it so hard, but you have no idea how it
turns out. Oh my gosh, I know, right?
I bet.
Nicola and I and Leo, like little monsters, we needed that, because that euphoria, that moment.
Sorry, just to give context to our listeners, it's when Leo's girlfriend picks him up from his top surgery, and they're sort of in the car driving home. And Leo, I think, says like, oh, we need to listen to Lady Gaga right now. Maybe it's on the radio. And he turns it up. It really is a beautiful moment.
I know. And like at the time, I was like, not that song. I know that song is owned by like five production companies. It's any other Lady Gaga song, please not that song. But they sing Always and Forever or whatever from that
Remember
movie.
Us This Way.
Yeah. And there are lots of things that happen in top surgery that were physical and interesting and like, you know, all the things that happen when you get top surgery. But the moment for me was that car moment. And even I realized my own sort of, I don't know if I want to call it transphobia, but lack of understanding, because it was the middle of COVID. I flew out to Florida. I was like, I'm going to go film Leo. this is kind of important. And then in my head, I was thinking, well, we're going to pick him up from surgery. And it's like, he's going to be in pain. It's post-surgery. It's going to be a bit of a downer. I don't even know why I'm filming it, but I know I have to be there. Mm. I didn't understand what joy there would be in that moment. Mm. I didn't understand what the surgery meant to him until I saw it with my own eyes.
So we had a lot of conversations about what transition elements would make it ultimately in the film, because obviously Leo is in this place of actually going through it. And I think that's the benefit of adding people to a team that are in the producing and the editing room, is that, again, the protagonist, whoever is the subject of a documentary, as they're going through it, it's very hard to be able to reflect on that and filter yourself rather than allow other people to deal with that. And so one of the most interesting conversations and wrestling that we did was around testosterone.
Mm. It was this amazing scene we had, which we took out. And it's when Leo first does tea. And I really liked it because it was this point in his life where he's like, he's making that step. He's taking that step. And the ambivalence that he feels is really, it's not even ambivalence, uncertainty, fear, all of it was in that moment. And he gets the thing, you know, the little bottle, and then he can't work out to put it into the syringe. And he gets a YouTube video and he's watching it. And then like, he's just about to put it in his leg and he looks up at the camera and he's like, you can't film me doing this. Camera switches off. And it was such a, because when all of us make really big life decisions, retroactively, we will look back and we're like, oh yeah, I definitely married the right person and did the right thing and the right job. But in the moments, everybody, I mean, maybe it's just me, but most people feel real moments of doubt when you make big life decisions. Most people are really like, should I marry this person or not? Right before you do it. And then you do it and it's maybe great or not or whatever. Like that's life. And I love that moment showed that. But as Alex and Sasha and lots of people pointed out, that is not what most people are going to read from that scene. And it's very about the body. And like, is it really about his skateboarding journey? Does it really help? Mm. And like, you may like it for these reasons, but that's not, it just looks like confusion and it's very personal.
Yeah. And the ambivalence, again, to a global audience could read as like, he doesn't know who he is.
Yeah.
Right. He's unsure. He's questioning. He shouldn't be doing this if he doesn't know. But to Nicola's point, like, most major life decisions are confusing and we are unsure and we're taking. And so I saw the merit of it, but it also didn't add to the story that we were trying to tell. And so that's illustrative of a lot of the different kinds of conversations that we had. And ultimately I think you don't miss it.
Yeah.
If it not being there, but I think it's an interesting behind the scenes revelation to share. I consider myself an audience first storyteller. Like, it is not all about me and my vision for what the story should be. I'm very interested and concerned and attuned with how an audience is going to receive and go on this journey with a character or a protagonist. And so that's always top of mind. But how are they going to read this? And what are they going to get when they walk away?
I imagine that it's a particularly sensitive zone of reportage or documentary in a sports film, because sports is so much about the body. But then you're talking about, you know, the physical transition, which is like carries so much baggage in the public discourse, and you're making this for mixed company. It's going on Netflix. So it's so interesting to me to hear about how y'all grappled with all of that. And thank you for sharing.
Yeah. That. I mean, yeah, it's a damn shame we can't talk like truly for hours because we barely scratched the surface. I just want to say, you know, truly to listeners, obviously stay on board, you know, in your queue right now. Go watch it. Stop what you're doing. And Alex and Nicola, like, thank you so much. It's such an interesting conversation, especially to have a bit of a behind the scenes kind of look at how this film came to be. But thank you both so much for coming on the show. And congratulations on, I think, just a really special and important documentary.
You're very kind. Thank you for saying that.
Well, that's about it for this month. Sad to see you go. But before we close out, we have a few things to recommend for your gay agenda. Brandon, as our guest of honor, why don't you go first?
Yeah, so this is very true to form for me. But my item is Rina Sawayama's second album, which just came out today, or Friday when we're recording this. It's called Hold the Girl. She's amazing. I can send you a playlist. But she's a queer Japanese British singer. You know, oh, wow. I listened to the album as soon as it dropped at midnight, so I'm a little tired. I also ordered the vinyl, limited edition, should be here hopefully in a week. One thing I really love about her music is, you know, she, I think, really seamlessly combines sort of different elements. And so, like, you get snatches of, like, Lady Gaga and Kelly Clarkson and Blink-182 and Korn and Limp Bizkit, just all these, like, different genres, specifically from, like, the 90s and, like, early 2000s. And she makes them feel very fun and fresh. I think another sort of interesting element of her albums is that they also explore through these sort of, like, genres, pop genres, maybe themes that are that can be sort of underexplored. So she talks about, you know, like the thrill of like queer intimacy. She talks about frayed family relationships because, you know, her family moved to London when she was, I think, 5. She was raised by a single mother. So they had a strained relationship. And so that theme comes through in some of her songs. She talks about childhood trauma. She talks about, you know, immigrant diaspora experiences. She talks about not caring about eternal damnation in her song, This Hell. She, I think, is just so fascinating. I've loved seeing her sort of ascent over the past few years. So that's my recommendation. Go check it out.
Well, Brandon, if you're okay with it, maybe we'll put that playlist on our show page so our listeners can experience your music mastery.
I love forcing my taste on people.
Jules, what are you recommending this month?
So my recommendation this month is a person, but, you know, like a multi-hyphenate talent that I just want, you know, who's kind of having a moment, and I just kind of want to shout that out. She's Hari Nuff, who's an actress, mm-hmm. a model, a writer. Listeners, you might already know her. You might have already encountered her. She kind of had this critically acclaimed role on Transparent, you know, way back in, I think, like 2015 or something, playing the character Gittle in a really interesting, surreal sort of flashback sequence. But she's also just been like working various international runways for a long time. She's going to be in that new Barbie movie, the live action Barbie movie. Wow. Like, you know, like she is going places. She's one of the dolls who is going places. And I'm a big fan. But she's just like been serving some of the fucking fiercest looks I've seen recently in photo shoots, but also, yeah, at different fashion weeks. And all I want to say is, like, I just want to spread the good news. Like, go follow Hari Nuff on Instagram. Like, literally, that's my recommendation. I just think you won't be disappointed. Yeah, if you want someone, like, fashion-forward, stunningly gorgeous, very smart, and someone to look out for to put into your social media rotation, go follow Hari Nuff and get, like, pumped for what's going to be the weirdest iteration of the Barbie expanded universe ever, I'm sure. since whatever my cousin was doing in my childhood, cutting off the Barbie's heads, of course.
I'm recommending another podcast this month because we're all friends here and we're allowed to listen to multiple shows. It's called The Loudest Girl in the World. It's a new podcast. As of this recording, there's just 2 episodes. It's a show by Lauren Ober, who is a DC queer who began to suspect that a lot of the struggles that she's been having in her life, including like difficulty relating to people, having certain meltdowns, interacting with people in a different way than many of her peers, might have to do with the fact that she's autistic. And so she didn't receive an autism diagnosis as a kid, which is when it happens for a lot of people, and which is the sort of diagnosis industry is sort of set up to serve. So she finds it hard but exciting and important to figure out in her 40s that she has autism. And it's actually her girlfriend, Hanna Rosin, who some of you might know from the Slate podcast universe, who is actually integral to this story because she has a teenage son who's autistic. Lauren spends a lot of time with him. And Hannah's sort of like, you know, Lauren, like all these things, like especially in the pandemic, like you feeling really disrupted with your routine and all these things you've been talking about, how when you were a kid, everyone was punishing you for never stopping talking. Like, you might be autistic. And Lauren talks about in the second episode about the experience of coming to realize and accept and first suspect that she might be autistic was actually similar to the series of emotions that she went through when she realized she was gay. Because it's a little bit of like, I want to understand this thing about myself. It's also a little scary. Like part of me is kind of hoping it's not true. But then actually when it happens, like it feels a little bit like a relief to have that sort of framework to understand what's happening inside. So it's a very, very funny and sweet and sort of unsparing, self-examine-y look at a very misunderstood developmental disability that I think the podcast could help a lot of people who don't fit the sort of reductive stereotype of autism spectrum disorder learn something about themselves. And I highly recommend it. It's called The Loudest Girl in the World from Pushkin Podcasts.
Well, summer's coming to an end. The leaves might be changing soon. And that means this episode is also almost over. But please do send us feedback or topic ideas or let us know what you're thinking. You can write us at outwardpodcast@slate.com. Or you can reach out to us via Facebook or Twitter, where we're at Slate Outward. Our producer is June Thomas, who throws the fastest curveball in the industry. If you like Outward, please subscribe in your podcast app, tell your friends about it, and rate and review the show so others can find it. The good news is Outward will be back in your feeds on October 19th. Bye, Christina. Bye, Brandon.
Bye. Great to see you both.
Bye.
Yes.
I enjoyed returning home.
You're always welcome here.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.